Hello, and welcome to the Classicist podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, we turn this week to California, your home state, mine as well. And when California makes national headlines these days, it's more often than not about the drought there. But you have a lot of people filing those pieces from Los Angeles or the Bay Area. You live in the Central Valley, sort of ground zero for all of this. So can you just give us a sense of how this plays out on a day-to-day basis? How is life there different because of the drought?
Well, it's very ironic because we in the Central Valley are actually sitting in the central and southern part of the state on the biggest aquifer in the world, maybe. But it's falling. And so anybody who is not in a municipality that has deep wells, that is, if you're like me, you have a domestic well and the water table is only 40 feet for as long as I've been born, since I've, you know, my entire life, and that's dropping. It's down to 80 feet. So if you have a well that's 90 or 100, you have to get in line and pay $30,000 or $40,000 to go deeper. But you can go deeper. And if you're an ag, we used to have surface water from snowpack out of the San Joaquin and Kings Rivers, and I'm a taxpayer of that irrigation district, and I haven't had any water in 4 years. That was critical because that was the way that you watered your crops, and it did two things. It replenished the aquifer, and then you didn't have to pump. But everybody's been pumping, so right now it's sort of like Wild West. Everybody, you just get up in the morning, you drive across country, and you see these derricks everywhere. And the idea is that I'm going to have the deepest straw and go down to this pool of water, and whatever it takes, if it's 300, 400, 500 feet, I'll do it. I'll pay $600,000 to $700,000 if I have to. That's the attitude that everybody has. The irony is that all of the Bay Area and Los Angeles reservoirs are still full because they have original 19th century claims on the last drops of Sierra Nevada and Northern California water. But due to the lack of snowpack, that supply at its source, if you go to Hetch Hetchy Reservoir that supplies about 60% of San Francisco or the Bay Area, or you go up to the Shasta Dam, or you go to the Colorado River dams for LA, they're pretty much empty. So, and these municipalities don't have aquifers. They can only pump about 12% of their water. So we're going to see an abject reversal if we have a fifth year of drought. All the people who wanted to divert reservoir water to the ocean for fish restoration, who really don't care about people in the interior who shouldn't, they think, be planting things like almonds, that was all predicated on these big full reservoirs that are in their midst. But when these things dry up and they have no more sources of water, then people, the 10 or 12 million people in these two areas that pretty much run the state, they're going to have to decide what they want to do. Do they not want to have water, or do they want to build more reservoirs and hope it rains and then they can tap it? We only tap about 20% of the snowpack and rain that falls in California every year, and we need to get up to be about 50%.
Well, to this point, there is a political and cultural dynamic in California that people who aren't from the state or haven't spent a lot of time there don't necessarily grasp, which is that the sensibilities of the people who live on the coast and the people who live inland tend to be dramatically different. And as you suggested a moment ago, it's really the people on the coast who run the show most of the time. Can you explain that schism a little for people who are unfamiliar with how this plays out?
It's kind of like Massachusetts and Mississippi in the same state. So the affluent white and Asian populations live in places like La Jolla, Santa Barbara, Malibu, San Luis Obispo, Monterey, Carmel, Palo Alto, Silicon Valley, Berkeley, San Francisco. And they set policy. So they want, take a couple examples. They want high-speed rail, but they do not want the first segment built in their area, i.e. Pacheco Pass to San Francisco. It's too messy. It's too dirty. So they want to experiment where I live, down between Fresno and Corcoran, even though there's no ridership there. So that's where high-speed rail will start. They like the idea of high energy cost for natural gas and electricity. We have the highest rates in the United States because of solar and wind mandates. But their temperatures are about 65 to 75 year-round. So I have an office up at the Hoover Tower at Stanford University. I've never turned on the heat or the cooling. I live in an area where today it's going to be 106 and I can't afford to turn on the air conditioning until after 6 o'clock. So, but that power was set by people who don't have extremes of temperatures to cope with. Same thing about the drought. They get all of their – they live in very artificial places, arid climates. Los Angeles and the Silicon Valley should not support more than 100,000 people if they depended on their aquifers. But they were creations of Owens Valley, Colorado River, California Water Project, Hetch Hetchy. And yet these people don't understand the artificial existence in which they live. And so they start dictating to other people, reservoirs are bad. We think they're unnatural. You shouldn't build anymore. What we have, the water shouldn't be used for unnatural agriculture. You should let it out the San Joaquin River to help salmon come back as they were in 1850. Help the Delta smelt. Oh, by the way, I didn't know that all my water is shipped in from the mountains. I didn't know that my conduit that brings me water goes right over the San Joaquin River, which I could easily donate my water if I wanted fish. So they live in a hypocritical and unrealistic cocoon, and it's all predicated on certain people doing certain things, growing food, pumping oil out of the ground, cutting timber, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't like any of that, and yet they're entirely dependent on a lot of it. And I think one more year of drought and their margin of error is going to disappear.
California is a beautiful place, and it's always inspired a certain reverence for nature. There have been conservationist impulses at work in the state for a long time. But the state that you're describing, Victor, sounds like a place that has moved beyond that into a sort of active hostility towards all of the things that are part and parcel of having a growing citizenry.
Yes, there's no middle. I think it's summed up, it's a pyramidal society. There's no middle class anymore. There's an interior that's sort of like Mississippi. Where I am, it's $80 a square foot for a house. Where I work, it's $1,000 a square foot. Where I live, you can't go to the emergency room or the DMV. They're just full of illegal aliens that are looking for social services. When I go to shop, everybody has an EBT card. But Mark Zuckerberg is in the process right now, the Facebook CEO, of buying homes all around the circumference of his house so he can pick and choose who his neighbors are. You know, one out of every three Californians that's admitted to the hospital has diabetes. One out of three to four, probably more like three, in the public schools doesn't speak English. 1/6 of all welfare recipients live in California. 22% of the people live below the poverty line. And yet we have the highest taxes in terms of sales taxes, income taxes, and gas taxes in the United States. And yet we have – our schools are rated 46th in the nation. Our highways are 49th. So you really do have a pre-modern society from, say, Bakersfield to Sacramento. Then you have a postmodern leisured affluent society along the coast, and they don't have anything in common anymore. And the coast dictates to the interior. And yet the coast – it's funny, too, because they want to be exempt from the ramifications of their own ideology. If we were to fly over Silicon Valley and hear all that rhetoric about teachers' unions and open borders and this is good, we would see private schools, not private schools, but really, really Tony academies, the West Coast version of, you know, Choate or Groton or Andover. And I'm talking about Harker, Menlo School, Sacred Heart, Castilea, and they're just booming. Because these very wealthy Asian and white people are scared to death that 20% of the public schools are Hispanic now, and they don't want their kids in those schools. They feel they won't be competitive. They won't give them the prep to get into Stanford or Harvard, and they want to go to a private academy. It's kind of like the South in the 1960s when they integrated the school.
How would you explain the change? Your family's been in California for a very long time. In the middle of the last century, the state was a magnet. There was this notion of something called the California Dream, which is remarkable. I can't think of another state that can lay claim to something like that. And yet the turn has been so dramatic. What happened?
Well, what happened was the left took over, and largely through illegal immigration and immigration of very affluent whites and Asians into the state from other places. But the old idea was – we're way ahead on racial terms because we have all of these immigrants from Japan and China and Armenia and Italy, and everybody's going to be judged on achievement. It's going to be an equality of opportunity society. We're going to turn you loose. California is going to be far thinking. They're going to think out of the box. They're going to build the California Water Project, the Central Valley Project, the freeway system, the UC, CSU educational system. It was way ahead of everybody else, but the problem was that that philosophy of classical liberalism was hijacked, and it became an equality of result society. So we pretty much allowed 10 million people to come in from Mexico illegally in the last 30 years, but we didn't ask anything of them, and we didn't ask anything of ourselves. We didn't say, we're here to help you. We want you to learn English. We want you to assimilate, integrate, intermarry the way everybody else has. Instead, we thought, there's so many people coming in, let's not judge them. Let's create Chicano studies, bilingual education, dual language, government services, interpreters. And we didn't assimilate them, at least at the rates that were necessary. So we have a huge Hispanic underclass. As I said, one out of every three people who's admitted to a California hospital has diabetes now. And that's largely the Hispanic population. And we have a health care crisis. And we used to spend 7% on social programs and 30% on infrastructure. Now it's flip-flop. So if you and I were to get today and we were to drive to L.A. on the 99 freeway, we would be scared to death when we hit two-lane crowded Delano area or Visalia area. The 99 is no different than when the state was 15 million people, even though it's got 40. So it's a dysfunctional society. It's sort of like Illinois. It's sort of like New York. It's sort of like any society. Detroit, it's the, you know, the logical trajectory of leftism and statism. And the only thing that's keeping it going is that there's a few industries, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, techies, Napa Valley, five or six universities, Stanford, Caltech, USC, UCLA, Berkeley on the coast, that and the banking industry, and then agriculture, tourism, that keep the state going. But it's not manufacturer, it's not middle class people. It's an underclass and a very few on top.
Final question then. To that point, I recall an essay that you wrote for City Journal a few years ago called California, Here We Stay. It was an argument for why, as bad as things were, the Golden State was a place worth staying in. When you get that question, when people say, you know, the conditions have gotten so bad, why don't you just pick up and move? What do you tell them?
I tell them, well, in practical sense, I have 45 acres in the original house that my great-great-grandmother built in 1871. I don't want to be the first link in the chain to give it up for psychological, I guess, reasons. But the other thing is, I'm really tired of everybody sort of giving in to the left. And so everybody doesn't like California, so they go to Nevada or Utah or Idaho or Wyoming or Montana or Florida or Texas. And that just makes it worse. Somebody was in Detroit and somebody just said, you know, I can't take Detroit anymore. And they turned it into, you know, a moonscape. And so I think that what people need to do is say, you know what, I'm not leaving, and I'm going to argue and bitch and complain until people return to sanity. And I think that's really important right now for the Republican Party, because they need to get off this idea that we have to get along, we have to be part of the establishment, we don't want to be called racist or homophobic, we got to do this, we got to accommodate. All that does is empower the left, and the left does not interpret that outreach as magnanimity to be appreciated. They interpret it as weaknesses to be despised. They really do. So you need to stand up and say, no more. You people are crazy. I'm not. And if we don't do that, then the country's lost. And it will be lost first in California.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. But join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist Podcast. And in the meantime, you can stop by hoover.org, where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.